Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. Now, this show is an attempt to create a community project based around seeking meaning in whatever form that is, and having that meaning-seeking system be, like I said, a creative implement. Now, we can live creatively. We can live our lives like an artistic project. We can treat our decision-making as a creative act. And the way that one bases their decisions is in their beliefs. And in order to know one's beliefs, one has to have some sort of self-acknowledgement or self-reflection or self-remembering, and the ability to look inside and know what one is feeling. And those things are based in deep-rooted beliefs. At least that's what I think. That's what I believe. And so it's possible to have subliminal beliefs and to have all of one's belief systems based upon external stimuli, which means that all the socialization and all of the knowledge or things that you've learned throughout life could be how you see your world. I would like to challenge that and put people in the driver's seat for their meaning-seeking systems, and that would be to encourage them to craft their own beliefs and their own ideas on what reality is. And I also want to push my idea of love, an unconditional form of love, a love that I think you are born with and that no one can take away from you, a love that can be unmarred, even though sometimes you may not see it as the sun may be clouded over. But I feel deeply in my own beliefs that humans and the actions of life as a whole are inherently good-natured. You know, I hesitate to say divine, and I do not see any deity per se, you know, but I feel that as our body has cellular pieces and participants that make all of the functions that our lives are possible, maybe the earth is an expression of some large mass of consciousness and we are its cells, or maybe the universe is one being and all these little pieces have crafted their own identities. And as our identification with the being we think we are, we begin to have this superiority of our own existence over anything else. And I think from this we can forget that we are working alongside every bit of existence, every creature, every speck of life in nature, and even the inanimate rocks. We are not solo, solitary creatures ever, ever. And so the tug that I think holds all of it together and keeps moving us forward towards some entropic destination, because nothing ever hesitates, there's this perpetual and constant change in life. And yet, we're fully part of it. And that change and that participation, I see as love. And I think it is what draws us to one another and is at the heart of what a relationship is between anything. And it doesn't mean to be any sort of sexual relationship. It could be completely platonic. It could be a relationship with a pet rock, or a relationship with a substance that may be negative and abusive. Or it could be a relationship with one's home and one's belongings and material prospects. It could be a relationship with ourselves and how we feel about ourselves and how our emotions come to mount. Yet, I feel inside myself a tug towards you and everyone and our planet and inherently existence as it is, or as it should be if I could see it. And I feel like I'm part of it, and that fills me with love. And that's why I aim to help, and I aim to be good to people, and I aim to try to be good to myself and those close to me. And I try to make right actions, and I try to express right speech, and I try to have the right livelihood. And when I have to support myself or feed myself or feed others and make a living, I feel that I should do the best job that I can and should, and that's because I'm part of something bigger than me. You see? But that's what I'm trying to do here on my show. That's what I'm trying to do for you and for me and for our world. And I hope that you find it helpful in some way, shape, or form. It might just be the ramblings of my own subjective opinion, but I hope you can relate to something. And my email address is very available in the show notes. And so if you do happen to relate to something, even if the relation is in strict disagreement, I would love to hear how and why, and I would love to have a discourse with you. And if you would like anything to be expressed on the show, or would like me to cover any specific topic or idea, I would love to take the opportunity to follow your referral. I happen to quote a variety of literatures that I find interesting, from religious to philosophical texts. And if you ever hear any sort of dates or anything that sounds wrong, if I misquote things, sometimes I can ballpark a number or a date or even a name if I mispronounce something. Please help me make this a better show. And I would love to have a segment at the end after my son's special segment where he gets to express his opinion, where I could possibly further elucidate and correct any misspoken dictums. But anyhow, I've been thinking a lot about effort and work again, and the ways in which our mind, or components of it, lay out tasks, and why and how different people approach tasks differently. And there seems to be a drastic array on a spectrum of applied work ethics. And I don't think that people are born with any specific drive to do things. I don't think we have like an inborn moral ethical compass. I think we sort of build these things for ourselves over time by being exposed to outside examples, things that affect us, and we make decisions on how we're going to act in the future. But people do differ from each other. Every single expression, I guess I keep saying that word quite a bit, but every single person has a different form of self that they have built over time. And like an oyster builds a pearl, there's multitudes of layers of impacts that create that. But people do have different temperaments, assuredly. You know, extroversion and introversion may be too dualistic and an inadequate way to depict human society. When you have black and white thinking, you cannot shun what's in between. Yet certain people do prefer certain things, and the nature versus nurture debate is completely insane and difficult to cast a vote into. But I do think that there is a communal component when it comes to working with other people, and that work could be in a vocational environment, or it could be working together in a home to take care of the kitchen, or to take care of the family, to take care of ourselves. When we are working with people, we can't help but be influenced by the people we are working with, and we can't help but influence them. When we have a good attitude, and not just like a superficially good attitude, but a involvement with what we are doing presently, which takes focus, and focus is uncomfortable and often exhausting. So it can take effort in order to immerse oneself into one's present moment. And sometimes work can be tedious and uncomfortable. And so that's the rub. You don't want to do it, but you have to throw yourself into it. When we are working with other people, it compounds all of the variables that turn our days into something that could be a drudgery or something that can be fulfilling. When you have two people who are intuned to each other through self-reflection coupled with observation of one's partner, so one has to know oneself, and through knowledge of oneself, be able to observe the other. And then there has to be a trust that the other is doing the same towards you. So I used to work on this rather large kitchen line, and my coworker, we'll call him R. And me and R were very different people. I'm strange and kind of lanky and not very normal. And R was like muscle bound and like an intense masculine dude. And from day one, immediately I realized that he didn't care for a single thing I had to say. And he didn't want to talk much either, which is very difficult for me because all I want to do is talk, like, a lot. That's what I do. And I learned several lessons through this partnership. Yet, because we didn't talk and because I didn't want to piss him off, I was just very vigilant. And I was ego-focused on his actions and our actions and how we were going to compile food and get the job done well. And this man was very smart, and I'm fairly sure he was doing the same towards me as a good partner. And because we never talked, we never had any negative shit to say, you know, and the atmosphere tended to be rather congenial, with no bickering or argument. And no shot calling, which led to a lack of leadership and role position. We were equivalents in the ultimate democratic fashion. After working together for months and months, we were so fast, and I could get to a point where I knew exactly where he was going to be and where he needed me to have food dropped and how to have things prepped and filled, and I was always where he wasn't when he needed to be there, if that makes any sense. And the guy was doing the exact same thing for me. So we were incredibly efficient, and we did a very good job. It's an example of, from one side, the practice of focus, you know, that active side. And I learned a lot from that, and I still work the same way. I'm always intensely focused on what my team is doing and where I can be the most helpful. And that has nothing to do with preference of what activity I would like to do. In work, especially on a team, I don't feel that preference is particularly ideal when people have things they would like to do, or even what I would like to do. I try really, really hard not to want to do things and not to want to be anywhere else. So I do the shit work a lot, and I'm in a position of pseudo leadership because people look up to me and expect me to support the team in that weird leadership role, even though it's never been discussed, and I don't tell people what to do a lot. Because if I have a management style in any way, it's very similar to how me and R work together. Even if I have 6 or 7 or more people, I'm going to put the other person first, and through acting good towards them and with proper observation, I can hopefully, in my optimistic mindset, leech or through some sort of osmosis what I'm doing onto somebody else. And I've watched it happen, where by simply working good with people makes them work better. Even if you've had a long-term employee who's been working for several years and has hit a sort of dead block with their own desire to better themselves, whether inside or outside the company environment, you know, act good towards them. And you might be surprised how it benefits you and the other person, and the team grows for it. And it doesn't have to do with force and effort and an attempt to make people do what you want, because that comes from preference and what you would prefer people to do. It starts with being where they need you. You know, that's what being good to other people is that respect. Imagine tribal man and woman and hunter and gatherer culture, where you have two families of people together who may be quasi-related, you know? But every single member of ancient man, I believed, were completely interdependent. And that voiceless, mindless, effortless, non-forceless way of communicating with each other, and that special go moment that I think I've witnessed at work and impacted, I think that's how the whole tribe was on. Everybody was linked into that feel, and it's the healthy sort of group mind that we could have. There's a lot of selfish ways to have a group mind. Negativity in the workplace, and not the sushi hippie sort of, you know, love is peace, just be positive, man. I'm not talking about that kind of negativity. But there's a certain flavor of talking about people, especially when they don't happen to be there. You know, you can walk around a corner and approach a situation and not even hear what people are talking about, but make a judgment call of what they're talking about. And you can hear that chiding, sniping, derogatory flavor of conversation that erodes human partnerships. In those situations, I try to look that other person in the eye and pointedly say something positive about the person that is not there. Oh, really? You think that? Well, I saw them do something incredibly good the other day. You know, I try to impact the respect for other people. Firstly, by respecting other people myself. You can only do the best for others by bettering yourself. In whatever way you want to decide what that is. You know, I can't tell you how to be a quote-unquote good person, because the subject of good doesn't exist, you know. But there is something special when you're good to another person, without any of that weird hoodoo. So, I think there's a way to not be, I guess, in the childish way. I remember children calling others bossy. But as adults, we get on these heavy power trips where we perpetually try to boss others. And you have to imagine a large percentage of adults are also parents. So they have this active clinical, you know, practice where they have to tell others what to do, even if they have no authority at work. So everybody's always telling somebody what to do in some way. I wonder how we could minimize how many times we have to do it, even ourselves. I see a sort of taskmaster sitting upon a throne within the subconscious of our mind's castle. You know, I have a very strict taskmaster, and I think that's because I was a single child and I was very misunderstood by most around me, including most of my aged peers and my father. And being alone, you learn how to do things for yourself, by yourself, and being inside that echo chamber is not the healthiest way of doing it, in my opinion. And I formed a lot of neuroses about how I interact with people, and I've had to learn a lot of different social implements. This has created in me a very strong, scented, arrogant, focal source, what I call my taskmaster. Because of this, I get a lot done. You know, I work very hard, and I'm a single parent, and I read and clean, and I drive to appointments, and I feed, and I cook, and I do all the things, and you know, I spend a lot less time than I would like in inactivity. 2 years ago, I used to sit in meditation for 2.5 to 3 hours every day on purpose, doing completely nothing, self-hypnosis. You know, and now it's hard for me to sit down for longer than 30 or 40 minutes at a time and read. And so I do it in quick snippets, and I change books often because of my short attention span. But most of the reason that I can't sit down and relax is because I'm relentlessly going through the list of to-dos that my taskmaster has set up for myself. And these are healthy, healthy systems that have made me successful and led me to a lifestyle that allows me to support my son. And we have a very high standard of living. And overall, I'm pretty happy, and I feel I'm happier than a lot of people. But I also spend a lot of time torturing myself in this self-deprecating form of misery instilled by self-overwork. In the past on the show, I've talked about a speedometer of sorts for willpower and action and how fast we push ourselves and how much gas and how much pressure is on the accelerometer in life, and how when we drive too fast, we drive dangerously and we can hurt people. You know, and then driving too slow, we never get to our destination. So there's an optimum speed that's in the middle. And I have gone through periods of overwork and underwork, and I've been trying to find that middle ground, which I encourage any and everybody to do. And the thing about middles is that since we're all unique individuals, your middle may be very different than mine. You know, you have different capabilities and you have different instincts and preferences and desires. So it takes an attunement of the vehicle and a knowledge of the vehicle to be able to know how to drive it in certain circumstances. So I want to subjugate my taskmaster so that it's no longer my taskmaster, but rather my task assistant, you know, in a dainty, stupid outfit. I want it to be humbled to my will and to my health so that I have control over when and how and where I get things done. So that I'm not frantically cleaning because I'm anxious, but I'd rather clean out of pride because I enjoy doing it. There's an approach to life you know, and I'm still figuring it out. And I assume that there's probably quite a few people out there that are too. So I want you to know that you're not alone. And it's not silly to be confused. And there's no reason to beat yourself up or to pity yourself for not knowing what you want or where you're going right now. Because I barely know. But in an atypical fashion, I want to be better and I want to see my world better. And I think I can do that by starting in a grassroots fashion with myself. And maybe you can too. By having an intense desire in what you are interested in, you may affect others and pass on that contagion of curiosity so that they desire whatever they want to desire as much as you do. And I think that's a beautiful thing. Even if what they desire is in disagreement to you. It's certainly something to consider. Either way, I want you to know I think you're a very special human. And I'm grateful that you woke up and that you are breathing right now. And that all of your autonomic functions in your body and all your cells are respirating. And I thank nature every day that you don't have to think about your cells respirating. I'm grateful for my own family, and I'm grateful for the people that you have in your life. And I hope that you're not in complete isolation. You should seek to get out of that if you are. Community and how we work with others and being part of what the Buddha called Sangha, the spiritual community. And that means the people who are actively seeking for themselves, and you can seek together, and it's so much less lonely. I want you to know that I am with you on your path, and I want to encourage you and what you find interesting and healthy for you. And I want you to know that when I see you thriving and when I see you happy, that makes me happier than I could ever be by myself. So thank nature, or thank God if you prefer that. Before we get to my son, I would like to read just a couple quotations just for you to consider and to have running, and maybe you can think about it this week. I will be back next weekend. I'm going to stop taking weekends off, and I'm going to get back to being more structured here. But sit on these words of wisdom from people long ago. Thank you. First, I would like to return to Aleister Crowley. He had a very negative reputation as an occultist and admittedly made several hedonistic, calculative, horrible things that did happen between him that he hurt other people with his philosophy. But within all things, I do find diamonds in the rough. And so I have been drawn towards certain bits of Aleister's philosophy. I'll be reading from chapter 8 tonight from the Book of Magic. And this is called The Sword. This is from the beginning of the chapter. It starts with a quotation. "The word of the Lord is quick and powerful and sharper than a two-edged sword." Down. "As the wand is Chokma, the will, the father, and the cup of understanding is the mother, Bina, so the magic sword is the reason, or the sun." So that means that the will, which is the ability to affect things, and understanding, which is the ability to absorb things, they're the mother and the father of reason, which is the use to affect things. Like, the will is like being able to move your body around, but reason is calculation to change the world, you know, which is why they call it the sun. Anyway, I continue reading. "The six Sephiroth of the Ruach, and they shall see that the pentacle corresponds to the daughter. The magic sword is the analytical faculty, directed against any demon it attacks, his complexity. Only the simpleton withstand the sword. As we are below the abyss, this weapon is then entirely destructive. It divides Satan against Satan. It is only in the lower forms of magic, the purely human form, that the sword has become so important a weapon. A dagger should be sufficient. But the mind of man is normally so important to him that the sword is actually the largest of his weapons. Happy is he who can make the dagger suffice. The hilt of the sword should be made of copper. The blade is straight, pointed, and sharp, straight up to the guard. It is made of steel, to equilibrate the hilt, for steel is the metal of Mars, as copper is of Venus. Sorry, he's got a lot of, like, bullshit symbology in here that I get confused with. But I'm going to stop there, because that's enough. I think what I found interesting about this segment in the book was how he has used the implements and the physical objects of his magical rituals. Because, you know, the scene in, like, Supernatural or any paranormal fucking magic-y wizard witch shit where they have the circle on the ground and the pentagram and the fucking bowl and the incense and lighter. Like, that's the kind of magic that Aleister Crowley and his cult of Thelema were practicing. And so, like, but he's using the objects from his rituals, which he had sunk immense belief into. And those objects have metaphorical meaning for components of his being and his existence. So this will and this understanding and this reason, which he, in the beginning, he's almost criticizing man's use of reason, because reason is how we force things. It's how we calculate and name things and devise things, you know. And Aleister, through many other sections of his book, has been openly critical of even thinking and the thoughts that come down the stream and all the bullshit and the rubbish, even though some of them are good, they're all extensively just objects and not actually part of who we are. Yet we find ourselves identifying with these thoughts and this reason. So when we affect things in our reality, we actually think we did it, you know, but part of it could be just spare chance. Maybe. So next, I'm going to read a chapter from my beloved Tai Ching. I've had a really good translation I've been reading recently by Ralph Allen Dale. This is chapter 25, Naming the Nameless. What preceded life? The earth. What preceded the earth? The universe. What preceded the universe? The soundless and shapeless origins of origins, ever transforming and having no beginning nor end. This mother of the universe is boundless and nameless. But if we wanted to share with you anything about this remarkable non-executing executor, we must invent a name for it. We will call it the Tao because Tao means great. Incredibly great because it occupies infinite space, being fully present in the whole universe and in every infinitesimal particle. Because this great integrity created the universe and the universe created the earth and the earth created us, we are all incredibly great. Life derives from the nature of the earth. The earth derives from the nature of the universe. The universe derives from the nature of the great integrity. And the great integrity is the omnipresent, omnigenous, omniform, the universal material and spiritual substance, and the holoversal interlinkage and coition of existence. So if you didn't know, coition is sexual union. I had to look that word up. So the metaphor he's using is that the way that the material and the spiritual are bound within this idea of Tao, which is very Brahmanic, if you have any understanding of Hinduism, where Brahma is the material, like the immaterial everything, you know, like all that, like, and I'm not going to go down that path right now, but the separation between the material and the spiritual, and our separation between ourself and our outside world, could be mythical forms that we are telling ourselves through some way of storytelling. And so I found it very intriguing how Mr. Ralph Allen Dale's metaphor he used was of sexual union, almost. When two humans are together, you know, it's been a spiritual practice, even in tantric forms, where the use of sexual union can be used to surpass the selfish I, that people can lose themselves in the combination of two humans and a soul. And people describe how the separation between them begins to blur, and that's part of the mysticism behind such a beautiful experience, you know? And maybe we can take that beauty when we try to link ourselves with our world and when we try to have a good relationship with our world. Well, that's all for me this week. Thank you. Let's see what Odin has to say.
Hello, people. This is Ask Odin the Gingerbread Man.
Woo!
I will smack your face, Dad. I smacked my dad's face. Whoa. Daddy, I'm going to give you a question. How was your week?
It was okay.
Was it cool?
Mm-hmm. It was okay.
How was your work?
It was okay.
I'm only going to be here for a couple minutes.
Only a couple minutes?
Yeah, because I smacked my dad's face 1,000 times.
Why don't you tell the people, wait, son, please don't hit me. Why don't you tell some the people something you learned this week?
I learned minus plus minus equals minus.
Tell me more about that.
Well, if the all this is a minus plus minus makes minus, it doesn't really make anything. Like two minuses makes zero minuses.
Can you give me an example?
Not really anything.
Well, thank you for speaking with us today, buddy. I love you.
Bye.
Thank you.